So hello, my name is Becky Griffin, and I'm with University of Georgia Extension, and I'm also the lead extension person on the Lights Out, Fireflies On campaign, and I am honored to have with me today Lynn Faust. Those of you in the Firefly world, of course, know who she is, know her name and her work. She is famous for her work on fireflies. She's a consultant to parks across the nation. She's written the book on fireflies, and we're excited to have her with us today. So hello, Lynn, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, Becky. Thank you.
Well, thanks.
Ready to talk about lightning bugs.
All right, lightning bugs. We're definitely Southern, so lightning bugs definitely needs to be the correct vernacular there. So can we start by asking you a little bit about your background?
My background, I went to University of Tennessee and majored in forensic anthropology, which is dead bodies and skeletal remains, and forestry. And halfway through, I left after my sophomore year for 3 years to sail around the world with my husband, my brand new husband, and another couple. So we were gone for 3 years, and I came back and finished my degree when we got home, and then started having baby boys. So it all kind of happened in a continuous stream.
Oh no, that 3 years sailing around the world, that's something else. Not many people have that opportunity.
Oh, it was amazing. And that's a totally different interview, but it was in 74 to 77. So the world was a different place then.
Yeah.
And it was before any of this electronic techno stuff we deal with now. And so we were very lucky. We got to visit cultures fairly well unchanged from how they had always been, and do a lot of diving where fish had never seen anyone underwater with scuba gear. And it was a great trip.
And so I'm sure that changed your whole perspective on everything. So
it did. It changed all of us for life.
All right.
But one memory, I did grow up as a child in the South in Knoxville, Tennessee, and then Lookout Mountain. And we did call them lightning bugs. I never heard the word firefly until I was 38 years old. And that's just how everything was a little more compartmentalized back then. You know, it wasn't on TV and it wasn't sexy and but anyway, so we called them lightning bugs. Fireflies is just fine. It's a regional difference. You will actually hear me use the word firefly more often because it's one less syllable, and I'm going to be saying it a lot. But fireflies, I mean, lightning bug speaks to my heart, but children aren't really using that term much anymore.
And I think those of us in the South say lightning bug.
Lightning bugs, yeah. But when we were sailing around the world, so I had grown up always loving outside nature. I'm miserable inside, I'm miserable in cities. So that was sort of bred into me, I think. But I do have one of my earliest memories of watching the lightning bugs in our backyard with my father, who had taken me outside to see the Milky Way and the stars. And in those days, in the 50s, you could still see the Milky Way right in the middle of Knoxville. You can't do that anymore. There's too much light pollution. But that night, we were looking at the stars. He was a pilot, World War II pilot. We were looking at the stars, and I became distracted by these things that looked a lot closer that were flashing. And when we, so I always had an interest in them, but no more or less than any other nature lover. And when we sailed, though, one of my many, many memories of the 3 years is being in the highlands of New Guinea. And we got caught driving at night, which in those days wasn't a really great idea. And that's a different story. But we stopped on top of a mountain to look out across a valley. We were looking at the Stanley Owen Range, and the valley below was filled with fireflies. And that's the first, I just sort of remembered that. Now I wish I could go back and,
yeah,
and catch them and see what they look like and all that. But at the time it was like, wow, they're everywhere, aren't they? They're not just in Tennessee or the South. So, yeah.
That's
so
cool.
I always liked, but it turned more into a passion around 1990 and 91. And that's this really long story I don't want to go into, but we had a cabin in the Smokies. We had, the park was taking our cabin, the entire community on the historic register, 100 years old. And we had to move out of our cabins in 1992. And anytime you're losing a loved one, it can be a loved place or a loved person, you become, and you have warning about it, you become more aware of everything. We had enjoyed our synchronous firefly display up there, Photinus carolinus, always. I mean, my husband's 80, he remembers them when he was a child up there. And so we had always enjoyed those. And it dawned on us as 92 came closer and closer that we didn't even have these down in the valley. We had pretty fireflies, but we didn't have what we had always enjoyed up there, and that we would be losing that.
Oh.
And so I switched, and also my children were still quite small then. And so everything happened gradually and accidentally. I did not go into this thinking fireflies were going to become my life. And that's kind of, it's year round now. It's crazy. And I wrote the book naively thinking, I was in a bad accident in 2011. I was bedbound. And I thought, you know, I've always wanted to write that book for regular people because everyone likes lightning bugs, fireflies. But there was no book out. There were a few children's books, and there was nothing for just a regular person to say, well, what do I have in my backyard, or what's at grandmother's house? And so as I sat in bed, and I had years of field notes already. I do field notes every year. Here's one from how to do this. And that's actually what I'm busy doing this time of year, is transcribing all my field notes. Then I print them out. And so I had all the stuff, but I thought, okay, I'm never going to be stuck in bed again. And if I don't start the book now, it's never going to happen. And so the accident in some ways was a blessing, but the argument with myself at the time, and this was 2011, was I didn't want to give a year of my life up. I'm very selfish with my time, and I'm scattered all times. I think you've picked up on that. And, you know, with just everything. And I didn't want to give up a year. And what I didn't know, and it was a blessing, it was going to be 6 years, not 1 year. I was going to be giving up 6 years of my life. And I did. And I'm glad I did. But at the time, sometimes it's nice what you don't know.
Right. And I have the book right here. I don't know if I can do this too, because we're blurred. But this is mine is dog-eared and written in margins. I've got species I'm looking at. It stays with me. So, and this
mine
is how, this is how I came to know about you and your amazing work. So, yes, 6 years of your life, it may have filled. I don't think wasted is the correct term. If this is what, you know, we get out, because it is very well written for the average person. The way you can determine flashes, and then when you find a species, you learn everything you need to know in the book. So it is very much appreciated, for sure.
Oh, thank you. And you might want to point out, it is University of Georgia Press.
Yes.
So it's coming straight from your state. And I was very appreciative. They were fun to work with, and we worked forever on it. So
sometimes University of Tennessee people and Georgia people can work together, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So, in your opinion, when we talk to people who are environmentalists, a lot of times I get pushback. I have a passion for fireflies. They're magic. To me, they're magic.
They are magic.
And I know that they're larvae who, you know, live in the leaf litter and in the wet stuff, does some great things for our environment. But when I ask you, what do fireflies do in our environment, for our environment, what is your answer to that?
Well, it could have so many levels, the answer. The very first thing you said, the magic and the awe for a human watching fireflies, which actually the fireflies don't care that we're there at all. But for us looking at them, they give something very special back to us. And it's they're charismatic, meaning everyone likes them. I always feel like I'm cheating because I work with fireflies and they're not political and people don't hate them and they're not trying to kill them. And so, but they give joy and they give magic and they bring people together. And so that's not really an environmental answer, but it's very important. if you've ever come to the Smokies to see the light show in June, and you see thousands and thousands of people holding hands, having granny with the walker, a baby in a stroller, sitting on a blanket on the side of the road as a family or as a group, a church group or a friend group, that's really providing something that we don't have enough of in our world.
Yeah.
Now, as far as environmentally, they're like everything else out there. You know, the web of life is truly that. And they're right there in it along with everyone else. And they're masters at chemical warfare because they are so small and so defenseless, and they're not very good flyers. So they've had to develop all sorts of ways to not get eaten by every bird and frog out there. And they do quite a good job of that. And as you said, the larvae are in the ground moving around, not unlike worms, and going through the soil. It depends on the genus of fireflies. Some are on top of the soil, some are under. And they're eating all sorts of little tiny things as larvae that we'll never know, but they're part of the balance of a soil profile. And when they disappear, they are a canary in a coal mine, but I always think, aren't we all? I mean, you know, you take any animal or human out of the mix, we're all part of the web of life. But when they disappear from an area where they had always been before, something bad has happened. And they're a fairly visible representation. Suddenly the lights go out at night and yeah. You go, gosh, we used to put lawn chairs here and watch, and now there's nothing. It's just darkness. And so, yes, it does tip you off that things are wrong, and it could be any number of reasons why, and usually as a combination of reasons. So is that good enough? But they don't, a few things do eat them. Some spiders specialize in them. But they're not eating that much because they're so chemically protected. And that's fascinating for anyone interested in chemistry going into how that happened. But similar to, everybody's heard of monarchs and milkweeds, and they operate in a similar way. They sequester, they take in chemicals and make themselves very distasteful to most predators, most but not all.
Well, I think that was a great answer. And you gave me something to think about I hadn't thought about. And that is that indicator species. And they are so visible. And I know I get people in my office all the time. I used to see fireflies or lightning bugs when I was younger, and I'll go visit their house and it's lit up like Fort Knox.
Oh, yeah.
You know, chemicals on the lawn. So yes, I know exactly what you mean.
I hear that everywhere. You know, oh, there were so many when I was little. Well, when these people were little, particularly if they're my age, there weren't as many lights. There weren't as many people. Mm-hmm. People spent more time outdoors. We didn't even have a TV in my early years. And so what some of them are not thinking is they've moved inside and they're staring at the blue screen of their phone, blinding themselves, and there's stuff to do at night. And with daylight savings time, even, you know, everything's different and not as many people are out as at night. What I love though is once in a while, and I shouldn't even say this. I do try to answer every single email that comes to me because people have taken the time to run me down. I don't do social media. And they found me, and they usually have a burning question or a picture they want to show me or something. And I like that because they're trying to learn more. But sometimes somebody will write me and describe something, and you have them up there in North Georgia, for instance, a blue ghost. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a blue ghost?
Yeah.
They're kind of wonderful. Everybody loves blue ghosts, and it's a good name, and they're really fun. And somebody will suddenly have accidentally seen one. They took their dog out in the middle of the night, or they came home late from a party or whatever. And they'll write me about it thinking they're seeing things. Once that person knows what it is, so the really good ones have taken a picture with their cell phone and they describe it too, because you really need to see the specimen when you first start identifying things. Once they know it's there, it's there, and they see it the rest of their life, and they show it to their friends, and they all say the same thing. I've lived here 30 years. I had no idea they were right here. And so you have to look, you have to go out at night. Don't be having your phone on, because that truly, particularly the older you are, just ruins your night vision. And you can have stuff flashing all around you and never see it. And don't have a flashlight in your pocket for emergencies, but go in the dark and maybe just sit there. Don't go barreling, you know, through the dark and break your leg. Yeah. But the longer you sit there, the more you'll see. And the lucky people have lightning bugs, fireflies in their own yard. Mm-hmm. Some people don't. If, you know, if they live in a lit up subdivision or where all the vegetation's kind of gone. But usually in the South, at least, you can find parks. Cemeteries are real good places. Somebody's yard that's a little bigger, or a farm, or even the side of a road, they're there. You just sort of have to find where they want to be. They're not going to pick a shopping center with a paved 100-acre parking lot. You know, they're gone from there. They are gone from there. But they're around, and just find them and enjoy them.
Well, I like what you said about the I had no idea. I have drugged my husband out many times to look for fireflies. And then one time he saw the blue ghost. And that was it. He's sold now. That was
it. Good. The blue ghost has made a lot of converts. Yeah, they've made a lot of converts.
Yeah, rightly so. Little ambassadors that they are.
They are good little ambassadors.
Our project in North Georgia, the Lights Off, Fireflies On, we're partly working with young people. Mm-hmm. To get more aware so that they learn about habitat for fireflies at their home. So as a young, I think you mentioned to me, young people have some advantages that those of us with a few years on us do not. What are the advantages of being a young person getting excited about lightning bugs?
Well, there's all sorts of advantages, and I want them to know that. I want them to know not everything is already discovered. Like, in fact, maybe 5% is discovered. So there's plenty left for them to discover when they start making discoveries. But a young person, give me a 10 or 12 year old any night to walk beside me in the forest, because they can see at night. They rarely need a flashlight, and their eyes are just so much better and more sensitive. And so often they will see the things first. And they are very flexible. They can get on the ground and creep around on the ground, you know, and not have to have somebody help them up. And so they also have a whole lifetime of summer evenings ahead of them. And so if they learn just a tiny bit each year, they can know a whole lot by the time they're adults. And like, my book is readable to anyone who can read. You know, it's not some academic thing where you don't know what I'm talking about. There are some words, but I define everything, and I have a glossary and lots of pictures, over 600 pictures. And so I've actually gotten a lot of emails from children, often probably 8 is one of the younger ages that writes me, but lots of 12-year-olds. And if that's going to be their thing, you know, they can get into it. And if you're in Georgia, man, y'all have got so many habitats, from the ocean to the mountains to down the Florida border. There's so many different species there. And so they're located in a great place.
Right. Well, I may have a little bit of late start, but I do try and learn one or two every year. And like you, every year I get more fascinated with them.
Yeah.
So talking about discovering, how does it feel when you find a species that maybe was rare or maybe people thought was extinct and you get to rediscover it? What is that feeling like?
It's a good feeling. It's a really good feeling. I've worked with the Xerces Society is really doing a push now with fireflies, and I'm very grateful. They got a great bunch of people and a number of other organizations. And when the Xerces started red listing, like seeing which ones are actually disappearing and which ones are doing okay. And in the beginning, I really didn't even want to participate. I said, well, I can tell you right now, the answer, we don't know enough about any of them. You know, I don't know how we can make big decisions when we really know where they are, and no one can identify them in the wild. And, you know, so, but luckily they ignored me and they forged on. But so we have data deficient. That means we don't know for, I can't remember now, maybe over 70% of the species. But little by little, they're hacking away and we're finding more populations and going about it in a systematic way. Just me as one person, basically every firefly there's exceptions, but most every firefly in the eastern U.S. comes out in a 6-week period, and that's it. And I can't be everywhere at once. Uh-huh. And, you know, I just can't do it. But luckily, there's a lot of people, I call them my stars, different people who have gotten my book and just taken it and run with it. And they, in their own little area, it might just be their yard or their farm. Some of them become regional experts, but I said, don't worry about the whole world. Just learn what's around you. And right. gradually you'll build on that, because you have to be able to not only recognize what you recognize, but also recognize when something is different. Mm-hmm. And I had that wonderful experience in 2017. My book had just been published. I did do some book talks that year, and I was in Mississippi. And on the way there, I hate to drive that whole way and not see some fireflies. It was May, and so I knew they'd be out. And so I had a little cabin at a state park for 2 days before I arrived on the speaking thing and trying to get ready and all. And that night, I just wandered out onto a boat dock in the middle of the cypress swamp, and I saw, without a doubt, something I had never seen before. And it was a very, very distinct flash pattern, which if it had just been these ones that sort of flash here and there, that's very difficult to tell those apart in the wild. But this thing had a flash train of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then whoo, it'd do a swoosh at the end. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, swoosh. Okay. And over and over in the cypress swamp over the water. So the habitat was very specific also. And so that was super exciting. And at the time, Jim Lloyd, who was the great fireflyer of the last 60 years, 70, 80 years, he died a couple of years ago, almost 90 years old. I called him the next morning. I said, Jim, I've seen something I've never seen before. And have you ever seen it? Because he had spent, you know, years traveling around looking at different things. And so ultimately, my co-author, who was an ex-ranger at this state park, a good photographer, because I had to go on. I had to go do my talks. He took some good pictures, because we had to have that flash train in the paper.
Right.
Because when people see it, they can then go out and find it, even if they don't even know. It's one of the few flashes you really can identify without catching the bug and having a microscope and having a lot of knowledge. And that's actually still happening. It happened in Louisiana with friends Doug and Gigi Franklin this year. I sent them the paper. I said, Louisiana ought to have these. I have never had time to be there. I'd been in Arkansas, East Texas, Mississippi, and, well, one part of Louisiana already that month, but I didn't have time to go by their place south of Shreveport, and I knew they should have them. So those two went out, and that was their entire training. I sent them a picture. I said, this is what the flash looks like, and this is what time it will happen. Each species has a time of night it displays, some longer than others. But anyway, they went out and found the first record in Louisiana, and so that was super exciting for them and us. So yeah, and then we have a paper, the Centellins paper. I don't know if you've seen that, Photinus Centellins. It's Faust, Hughes, Loba, and Farrington. We extended the range of Photinus Centellins, which we call the pink winkers. It's another real popular name because they almost flash pink, and they're along the forest floor, and they're pretty generic. These are ones where you agonize, because there are several that kind of look like that. But anyway, they were considered the Photinus. That's a genus. That's sort of the larger group. They're different groups of fireflies. They were considered the smallest radius of where they existed for any Photinus in the world. And it was supposed to be eastern Pennsylvania and a little bit in New Jersey, just this little circle, and a little bit in Maryland. We extended that range 1,200 miles.
Wow.
And so we got it all the way to Missouri. And so part of it, again, they kind of look like everybody else that flashes at dusk. There was no one out there that could recognize them, and there was no one looking. And so I have two colleagues in Ohio, Laura Hughes and Mark Zlobaugh, and Mark caught them at a family reunion. And again, Mark knew enough. He knew his Ohio fireflies. And he emailed me the next day. He said, there was something different about these. And that's how some great discoveries are made. He knew plenty, but he knew he had not quite seen the pink winkers before. And that was actually at his aunt in Indiana. And from that, we did studies out both directions. And so it's now has one of the largest ranges.
Wow. Butterflies can be so exciting.
Yeah, oh, we think so. I mean, we get super nerdy about it, but yeah, it is exciting. And then North York, well, and then Laura, who is one of the co-authors on that paper, she's an excellent, excellent naturalist, and she knows her fireflies. She's young, and she can dissect better than me now. But a couple of years after that, maybe about the same time, and she's a biologist, worked for the EPA, does stream stuff. So she's outside all the time. She's also a nature nut. And she got home from a full day of being in four different counties in Ohio and looked down at her shirt, and there was a lightning bug firefly on her shirt. So she looked at it, and again, she thought, I don't know, that looks a little different from what I'm used to seeing. And she knows all sorts of species. I was babysitting grandchildren in Wyoming at the time, and she sent me pictures. And she said, what do you guess this is? And I was kind of covered up with toddlers. It's like, oh, well, that's, and I gave her the name of a common species. I said, I think that's what it is. And she's too polite to argue, but she went ahead and dissected it. And this is not something I recommend everyone to do, but for the people that become very serious in their area, there are certain species you really can't confirm what they are unless you dissect the male genitalia. And you got to have a microscope, and somebody needs to show you how to do it the first few times. But she did it. I taught her, and she quickly was better than I was. She did it and sent me pictures of the, it's called the Ediagus, and that's the male genitalia. And still out there in Wyoming, and I looked at them. It's like, yeah, that's what I told you it was. I told her it was a marginalis, which it wasn't. And she still didn't argue with me. And that night, I woke up in the middle of the night because I looked at the pictures. I was distracted. And if you get your mind that you know something, it's really pretty hard to change, yeah, change your thinking on it, particularly if you're busy and distracted. It's easier to believe what you believe. I woke up in the middle of the night. I thought, holy moly, that was not a marginalis, the Ediagus. She's got an acuminatus, a pointy lobe firefly, which was considered extinct and had never been in Ohio. It was down in Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, South Carolina, but it has a very distinct, when you dissect it, that's how you know. And so that led the possibility they're not extinct if there's one on her shirt. But the big question was, she had been in four counties that day. Did it fly in her car in the morning? Had it been on her shirt all day? Was it in her garage when she got home? We will never know, and she's never found another one. But that possibility opened up with the Xerces Society and their firefly specialist, Richard Joyce, who's great. It put it back on the list to see if it still existed. And we have found a new population in South Carolina. We know of another one in Georgia. We want to check. Again, there's never enough time.
Right.
And, but that will be checked. We're trying to hone in on exactly where a specimen was found, you know, like 50 years ago. And you try to go back to that place and see if that still exists.
One really wanted to be noticed. You know, yeah. You looked at me able to land on your shirt, so you pay attention. Yeah.
And it could have landed on any person's shirt in the United States. I am fully convinced if it had not landed on Laura's shirt, no one would have noticed. They would have kind of gone, oh, you know, flicked it off, or, oh, look, a firefly, and then put it on a leaf. She really, I believe, was maybe the only person out there. So it was kind of all meant to be.
Oh, yeah. So the question
But what I suggest, you have some students, you know, that are interested in nature, and I suggest all students get outside more. Mm-hmm. That really worries me. Worries me. But to start with their yard or wherever it's closest, and don't go try to learn 125 species. Just find one that they can recognize. And it usually starts with the Big Dippers. the ones that come out at sunset and do a little slow J stroke. And that's a good one to learn with. And once you learn what that one looks like, you know, then you'll start to notice if one doesn't look like that. And so start small and just learn what you have. And then it sort of gradually extends once you, you know, so get better.
You mentioned earlier that in the Southeast, we have about a 6-week window. And what is that 6-week window?
It's general. It depends on, you know, the further south you are, the sooner it begins. And so that was a gross generalization. But for my field study purposes, it's frantic. It's just frantic the whole time. The biggest season is basically mid-May to the end of June, or even early May if you're very far south. However, we have a flashing species that begins in February in Florida. And it goes all the way to Canada, and this is Practomena borealis. It's the, we call it the spring treetop flasher. And so I get reports, and I have people through the years that write me that are enthusiastic fireflyers, and they all try to be the first of the year to see that first flashing firefly. And so we have a really good guy in Florida and a really good one north in New Orleans. And they're in competition every year. It's like, I saw it tonight. There were five. And, but it will start early February there. And then you can watch it on a map. I can track it just from emails coming to me as it travels north. And in Tennessee, well, around Athens, Georgia, they usually get everything from 1 to 2 weeks before we do in Knoxville, Tennessee. So it's fun. And then it travels all the way up to Canada in June. So the season of a particular species, depending on the latitude and the elevation, and Georgia has both. You know, some states kind of flat and they don't have that much elevation, but Georgia, Tennessee, it really matters if you're at 6,000 feet or 1,000 feet or, you know, whatever. So, but generally it's May and June, but we have flashing things in March.
Nice.
And we have a winter firefly that's already out for next year. And that just blows my mind. It's already been spotted in Ohio. Laura, the same one with the shirt. And it's the Alycnia carusca. And that's called the winter firefly because you see them in the winter. And they're capable of freezing. And they come out as adults in the fall before the next spring, and they spend the winter as adults on the sides of trees. And that's a really amazing adaptation that most of the species don't have. And they'll be on the south sides of trees because that's where the sun is.
Is it any species of trees or just a warm?
I have a whole big paper called Fireflies in the Snow, if you want to look it up, or I could send it to you. It's the south side of large diameter oaks and tulip poplars, usually. And we think that's because, well, I have a list in the paper how many other species, but that's where I always look first. The oak or the tulip poplar, they have very deep furrowed bark and they can get on the south face of it and the sun shines on them. And that's one of their ways they stay alive when it's cold. They can absorb the heat, but they're kind of hidden from the rain down in the furrows. So they like deep furrows in older trees. So start looking. You may find some.
That is amazing. And I tell you, you're so enthusiastic, and that is just so wonderful. It's just so much fun to talk to you. do you have a favorite firefly species, or does it depend?
Everyone asks that. Yes. It's usually the one I'm working with right then. They're all favorite. And then when I find out something really cool that they seem to do that none of the other species does, that just makes me like them more. Yeah. But there's some of the, I like all of them. So that's kind of like asking if you have a favorite child.
Yeah.
But I'm proud of them for different ways. And I'm worried about some for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But they're all pretty amazing. And we also have daytime ones that don't even flash. And most people are not interested in those. And actually, the winter firefly does not have a lantern. It doesn't flash. It could not spend energy in the winter having a flash. And so I even like daytime fireflies where a lot of people, their eyes roll up. It's like, it doesn't flash. I'm not interested. But then you have some of the daytime ones that have retained the ability to flash under stress. And okay. Some of the ghost family, some of the, there's more than just the blue ghost. There's a shadow ghost and anyway, a low country ghost, several of them undescribed still. And they're very interesting because in the Smokies in Tennessee, our blue ghosts can keep their light on over a minute. I mean, you see them and they glow and glow and glow. As you get down toward Georgia, they glow shorter amounts of times. Mm-hmm. In the low country.